This time on your weekly Constitutional.
There's been a lot of discussion recently in the news about trying to focus law enforcement, national security resources into fighting domestic terrorism. A lot of people, I think, feel as though we've done a lot, and we've done a lot effectively to combat international terrorism and foreign terrorism. But with the increase sort of focus on things that are happening within the continental United States and some of the terrible shootings that have happened, people have been concerned about and wondering whether or not we should try to combat domestic terrorism the same way we do international terrorism.
That was Doug McKechnie of the United States Air Force Academy. It's your weekly Constitutional. I'm Stuart Harris, and our subject this week is, you guessed it, domestic terrorism.
Welcome to your weekly Constitutional, underwritten by the Robert H. Smith Center for the Constitution at James Madison's historic home, Montpelier. Your host is Professor Stuart Harris, who teaches constitutional law at the Duncan School of Law of Lincoln Memorial University.
For many years, at least since 9/11, there's been a popular image of the so-called terrorist. Typically, it's a young man, typically from somewhere in the Middle East, typically motivated by some sort of extreme interpretation of the Quran, shouting foreign phrases and doing terrible things. But since 9/11, such people perpetrating such crimes have been vanishingly rare in this country. Another kind of criminal has emerged, and this is typically a man, sometimes middle-aged, sometimes younger, typically native-born, who gets himself a very powerful weapon, lots and lots of magazines with lots and lots of bullets, and just starts shooting people, seemingly, in some cases, at random. Well, over the last 20 years, people have started to notice this trend, and of late, a term has emerged in the discussion, domestic terrorism. Now, certainly these mass shooters are criminals, but are they terrorists? And what's the significance of pinning such a label on them? Well, fortunately, to answer all those questions definitively, we have Doug McKechnie of the U.S. Air Force Academy. If you're a longtime listener, you know him as our First Amendment guy. But this time, we're going to talk about national security. Doug, welcome back to the show.
Thank you, Stuart. Thank you for having me.
You're sort of like a jack-in-the-box. Every time I look around, you pop up. That's because you know so much stuff.
Well, there's always a reason to talk about the First Amendment and the Constitution and current events.
Indeed, there is. And in fact, you and I were recently emailing back and forth because I had a perfectly delightful discussion with your friend, Eric Merriam, about the transgender ban in the military and whether that's constitutional or not. And I appreciated your having hooked us up. It was just a great interview. If people are interested, it's available on our website. Just look up transgender ban. And we had a great discussion on that. And then it just sort of naturally did what it always did, our emailing back and forth. You mentioned another current issue that you thought would be worthy of an episode of the show, and I agree heartily, and that subject is domestic terrorism. What are we talking about here?
Well, there's been a lot of discussion recently in the news about trying to focus law enforcement, national security resources into fighting domestic terrorism. A lot of people, I think, feel as though we've done a lot, and we've done a lot effectively to combat international terrorism and foreign terrorism. But with the increase sort of focus on things that are happening within the continental United States and some of the terrible shootings that have happened, people have been concerned about and wondering whether or not we should try to combat domestic terrorism the same way we do international terrorism.
That's a really good point. I mean, I hope I'm not jinxing things by saying this, but there have been, if I recall correctly, no attacks by so-called Islamist terrorists within the United States since 9/11. But there have been a number of mass shootings in particular that are tied to so-called white nationalism. I mean, most notably, this recent attack, tragically, in El Paso. Indeed, I've heard it said, reputable sources in the press, that the so-called white nationalist domestic terrorism is a far greater threat right now than any other sort of terrorism.
The FBI, director of the FBI recently testified to Congress that the FBI is is actually spending a lot of resources, manpower, and other sorts of resources on trying to root out and prevent domestic terrorist attacks, almost to the same extent as international foreign terrorism.
Well, you got to go where the threat is, and you're just as dead if somebody from the United States kills you as if somebody from Saudi Arabia kills you. So, okay, so we've got an issue. It's increasingly apparent to everybody, including Christopher Wray, the director of the FBI. He's testified on it. So the first question I have here is that do we need really to do anything else other than allocate resources, as apparently is already being done? I mean, anything that we might call domestic terrorism is probably already illegal from its earliest inception as a conspiracy, which is illegal to conspire to commit a crime, all the way through the end of it. If somebody detonates a bomb or shoots a bunch of people in a shopping mall or a school, all of those things are already very illegal and would be things that either state or local or federal police could already look into and have lots of resources to do so with. So is there some need for us to have a legal response to this rise in domestic terrorism?
Well, some people argue that there's not. Some people argue that, as you say, there are many, many laws on the books that can punish someone for murdering for no reason or for any reason. Murder is against the law, whether you're doing it to sort of intimidate government or try to influence policy. And so whether you're a domestic terrorist or just a random shooter, that's against the law to murder and to participate in other illegal activities. Some people argue, though, that in the same way that we have I don't want to use the word elevated, but that's maybe the word that comes to mind. Elevated the importance of international terrorism from a resource perspective and from an attention perspective. If we elevate the profile of domestic terrorism in the same way, we draw an equivalency there with regard to the nature of the threat and the need to act.
So this is in some sense a symbolic or would be a symbolic gesture if Congress were to pass some sort of domestic terrorism statute or if it were to authorize the creation of a new agency or to rename part of the FBI, you know, the Domestic Terrorism Force or whatever it is. Any of those things and certainly any additional resources they might provide would have not just a practical effect, but a symbolic effect and would focus more of the nation's and the bureaucracy's attention on this particular problem.
In addition, there are some laws there are some laws that could theoretically come into existence that might be focused more on fighting domestic terrorism the same way that we fight international terrorism. And so, for example, a senator out of Arizona and a representative, a House representative out of California just introduced bills to create a crime of domestic terrorism. And so at the federal level, both international terrorism and domestic terrorism are defined, but international terrorism is actually outlawed, whereas domestic terrorism as a term of art is not outlawed. And so there has been some movement towards introducing bills in Congress that would outlaw the idea of or actions in furtherance of domestic terrorism in a way that mirrors almost exactly international terrorism.
Let's talk about that a little bit because there is a difference. I mean, there's a difference right now. The typical examples I will use are Oklahoma City, where you had Timothy McVeigh primarily and his accomplice, who were both U.S.-born citizens, who had some strange reason for blowing up a federal building in Oklahoma City and killing a bunch of kids in a daycare and leaving a big hole in the ground. And that was treated pretty much just as a domestic crime, and the FBI investigated, and they found the axle with the serial number, which led them to the rental agency, which led them to McVeigh's accomplice, which led them to McVeigh. They captured him. They gave him a trial. All the panoply of rights were given to him. He was eventually convicted and lawfully executed. So, you know, a crime, FBI, punishment. Then, of course, you contrast that with 9/11. And there you had a bunch of people, mostly from Saudi Arabia, I think, maybe all, at any rate, not U.S. citizens, who hijacked planes and drove them into various buildings and killed lots of innocent civilians. We treated that completely differently in our response. It was actually a much more militarized response. And there was not nearly so much concern about constitutional rights. In fact, when we finally caught up with Osama bin Laden, he didn't get a trial. He got a bullet in the head. So two very different regimes. Could you talk a little bit about the legal differences between these domestic crimes and how we combat international terrorism today?
I think the way to understand how and why we approach those two questions in different ways is to really understand appropriately for your program is to understand the sort of constitutional framework for each of those sorts of crimes. So the idea of domestic terrorism and the Constitution with regard to the rights that Americans have versus the Constitution and to the rights, if any, that foreign nationals and international terrorists have. And so I think that to understand why there aren't laws on the books necessarily that are focused on criminalizing domestic terrorism as an act, to understand why that is, we have to kind of go back and understand the constitutional angle, not just that there is a constitutional angle, but what it is and why. And really, I think fundamentally, it comes out of two parts of the Constitution. First, the First Amendment and free speech, in addition to the freedom of association. That's sort of one, I think, reason that we treat these two types of activities differently, foreign terrorism versus domestic terrorism. And then on the other hand, I think the Fourth Amendment also has a significant role in how and why we treat international terrorism and domestic terrorism differently.
Yes, I believe that's true, and we'll talk about both of those in just a second. I think there's also another issue, and it's one that's often overlooked in constitutional law, and that's simply geography. I joke with my family that I've sent all of them in the last few years over to China. I'm the only member of my immediate family that hasn't been there, and far from feeling deprived, I tell everybody who asks me that I don't particularly want to go to a country that has no constitutional protections, as I understand them. Our Constitution doesn't extend much beyond our borders, and really only does so to the extent that there are American military or diplomatic presences in other parts of the world. So whereas I might feel very safe going to Canada or going to the UK, not so pleased to go to some place like China or for heaven's sake, think North Korea, and that poor young fellow from UVA, I think his name was Warmbier, who was beaten into a coma while he was there, and there's not a darn thing we've been able to do about it. So there is a difference, and it's a geographical difference. It's also an Article II difference, because whereas the president has as many constraints on him acting domestically, not nearly so many when he's acting as the czar of foreign policy or military policy, when he's exercising his commander-in-chief powers. So I've often given the hypo to my students. You know, imagine yourself as president of the United States, and an aide comes in and tells you that there's been an attack on the country. You basically got two choices. You either call the FBI and have them investigate, like we did in Oklahoma City, or you call the Secretary of Defense and the gloves come off and you have a military response. And typically, that's how we would divide it, you know, domestic versus foreign. And that has made its way into our statutes, hasn't it? I mean, we've got actual statutes like the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act that reference the fact that things are different when Americans are involved as opposed to foreigners, and different when things happen on our soil versus foreign soil.
That's true. And really what that sort of evolved from, or where that came from, was in cases from the 1970s. Cases like, for example, a case called the Keith case, mm-hmm. where a couple Americans bombed a CIA office in Michigan, and the government was able to put them in jail using evidence that they had collected without getting a warrant. They were wiretapping some of these folks before they had committed the crime, and so they had some telephonic evidence that they had been conspiring to commit the crime. And the government said, hey, look, this is a national security issue. We don't need to go and get a warrant when we are combating national security. And it was a unanimous decision. And this was from the 1970s. The Supreme Court said, yes, on the one hand, the president does have inherent constitutional authority to protect the U.S. But on the other hand, we've got Fourth Amendment rights, and there is a right to privacy, and there are requirements placed on the government before it goes in and starts listening to our phone calls. And there's sort of a First Amendment angle there as well, because the court said the reality is, remember, this is in the 70s, the 60s and 70s, and the government is concerned about anti-war protesters and communists and other subversive activity. And the court said, you know, when the government is listening in on phone calls without a warrant, oftentimes the people they're listening to are those folks who have unorthodox political views. And so the Fourth Amendment protections are just as important for us to be able to exercise our free speech rights. And so as a result, the court said, look, if it's a domestic, even if it's domestic intelligence gathering or domestic criminal investigation, if we're talking about American citizens, national security is not a trump card, and the government cannot collect that sort of information, that sort of evidence without a warrant.
It's a Weekly Constitutional. I'm Stuart Harris, and my guest today is my old buddy Doug McKechnie of the U.S. Air Force Academy. We're talking about domestic terrorism, and most recently Doug's been telling me that despite what you might call an American citizen who's accused of something bad, you still have to respect his or her Fourth Amendment rights. Stick around. You're listening to your Weekly Constitutional. I'm Stuart Harris, and now it's time to continue our discussion of Doug McKechnie of the U.S. Air Force Academy. We've been talking about the difficulties inherent in combating something called domestic terrorism. How does that differ from combating international terrorism? Well, it turns out geography matters. So the starting point was that the executive, the president, back in 1970, so this would have been under the Nixon administration, the first one, and J. Edgar was still around, I think, at that point. Their sort of default position was, if we're investigating a national security threat, it doesn't matter if it's here or abroad or whether it's Americans or foreigners or some combination of them. We just do what we do. We wiretap, we surveil, and then, you know, if we get evidence, we don't really worry about the constitutional niceties. We just haul them into court and convict them because national security. And in the Keith decision, the Supreme Court said, not so fast, you guys, at least not when it involves American citizens, at least not where it's here. So that's where the division began, was giving greater, or I should say, giving complete constitutional rights to American citizens who had been denied them, at least in the context of that case.
And what's interesting is the court in that case specifically said, you know, while we are talking in this particular, in the Keith case, while the court was talking about electronic surveillance of domestic threats of American citizens, the court specifically said we are not addressing whether a warrant would be required if the subject of the surveillance was a foreign power or a foreign agent. And so the American public had to wrestle with the idea of, you know, now that we're finding out, because the media started to expose intelligence operations that had been happening throughout the 20th century, lots of examples of the federal government, the FBI and other agencies wiretapping people who had been suspected of subversive activities. People started getting very upset. Watergate happens, and ultimately the Senate sets up what's called the Church Committee to do a real investigation.
That is something, if you've never read it, you need to read. I had been somewhat aware of the Church Committee hearings. Having grown up in that era, I was a teenager at that time, so I was aware of these things. But it was only years later, when my younger son Ben was doing some research in this area, he said, Dad, have you ever actually read this? And it's all available online. It's incredible, the stuff the CIA had been up to. I mean, you've heard oblique references to what these strange plots the CIA was engaged in and the governments they were overthrowing. A lot of it is really true. They were doing lots of really weird stuff, and the FBI was right there with them, you know, spying on Martin Luther King and on anybody they didn't like with long hair and peace signs.
The federal government was wiretapping U.S. senators, civil rights activists, Martin Luther King, Muhammad Ali.
He's a threat, obviously. You got to get him.
So lots and lots of public figures, public officials, senators were being wiretapped, and the American public was outraged. And so this Church Committee is set up. They do these investigations, and ultimately they decide, okay, we've got the Supreme Court has said that American citizens, whether it's part of an intelligence collection or whether it's a criminal investigation, American citizens, when they are the subject or the target of the investigation, they have Fourth Amendment rights. The government must get a warrant. But on the other hand, the Church Committee said, you know, there are going to be times where the federal government has legitimate intelligence concerns regarding a foreign actor or a foreign target. And so in that situation, the Senate set up, or the Congress set up, what's called the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act.
And that act, correct me if I'm wrong, attempts to set up a regime with a secret court involving sitting federal judges. So these are people who've already been confirmed by the Senate and so are presumably patriotic citizens of upstanding moral character, who are trusted with all sorts of secrets on a daily basis in their courtrooms, who now are going to be designated to sit on a special court where the government will go to get its warrants in cases that require secrecy.
That's right. And these warrants from the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Court are really warrants to conduct some sort of surveillance when the surveillance is focused on collecting intelligence about foreign governments, international terrorists, foreign political organizations. So it's really focused on not domestic threats, but foreign threats. And it can be focused on U.S. citizens who are believed to be agents of foreign governments or foreign terrorist organizations.
Which is a very common technique. In fact, I think that is probably the most common intelligence technique, is that citizens of country one try to recruit citizens of country two to spy on their own countries. So the Russians, for example, might try to recruit, you know, members of our intelligence community, American citizens, to do nefarious things for them here. And so you've got a situation where you've got, 9 times out of 10, some domestic as well as some foreign involvement. And so a given telephone call or email message or whatever else it is would involve one American and one foreigner on that particular thing. So we've got this thing we call FISA, for Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act. We have this thing we call FISA courts.
Well, here's the interesting thing about FISA, is that when we're talking about American citizens, the American citizens have a unique sort of carve-out within the FISA law. And the carve-out is this, is that an American citizen, when the government is trying to get a FISA warrant, an American citizen cannot be the subject or the target of that warrant if the federal government believes that the citizen is acting as an agent of the foreign power simply because of the American citizen's First Amendment rights. And so in other words, if an American citizen is advocating in favor of, let's say, ISIS or some international terrorist organization, the federal government cannot get a FISA warrant simply because that person is advocating on behalf of the terrorist organization.
Oh, okay. So if ISIS is sending emails to an American citizen urging that American citizen to get on social media and post pro-ISIS things, that's First Amendment activity, and that's protected activity, and so you're not even going to get a FISA warrant for that kind of situation.
Well, there might be a connection. If the person is acting as an agent, then that's a different story. But if the person is not connected to or is just sort of independently advocating in favor of some sort of international terrorism, then that's then they can't be the subject of a FISA warrant.
Okay, but if there is that agency relationship or conspiratorial relationship, that active relationship, then that would possibly result in a FISA warrant.
That's correct. Now, why it matters is that, and sort of this is the distinction between a FISA warrant and focusing an investigation on foreign terrorists or foreign agents, foreign governments. The difference is really what comes down to probable cause. And probable cause is a unique term within the context of the Fourth Amendment. And basically what it means is you've got to convince a court that there is a good reason to believe that you're going to find evidence of criminal activity. And so if the government wants to search your house because it thinks that you've got some evidence of criminal activity, it's got to prove to a court that there's a good reason to believe it will find that evidence. Under the FISA law, the government doesn't have to prove that it will find or likely find evidence of criminal activity to get a FISA warrant. It only has to prove that there is probable cause to believe that the target of the investigation is a foreign power or the agent of a foreign power. So there's really no requirement that the government prove that it might find or will likely find evidence of criminal activity, only okay. that the target is a foreign power or an agent of a foreign power.
So I understand that there is a greater concern about both First Amendment and Fourth Amendment rights when American citizens are involved, as they might very well be involved in many of these cases. And so we're going to try to protect those rights one way or the other. Are there other sorts of statutes out there besides FISA that might guide the government when it's dealing with what we might call domestic terrorists?
There is. So FISA, again, is focused on the foreign threat to national security. But when we're thinking about the government's concern about domestic threats or threats by American citizens, there's a totally different law, totally different statute that governs the federal government's ability to essentially listen in or wiretap on our phone conversations. And it's called the Electronic Communications Privacy Act.
ECPA. I should just interject here for those who are interested in this. We've done an entire episode on ECPA. And in fact, we interviewed a federal magistrate who is often asked to issue orders authorizing eavesdropping on things like emails. And the magistrate was very, very concerned about the amount of power that he has under this statute. So a very controversial area of the law. So tell us about the Electronics Communication Privacy Act.
Well, what I think is interesting, and this is sort of the Fourth Amendment, First Amendment sort of constitutional distinction between focusing on a domestic threat and an international threat. The ECPA, as you call it, the Electronic Communications Privacy Act, the burden is much, much higher on the federal government. And that's because the federal government wants to listen in on American citizens' phone calls. Mm-hmm. And so if you remember, under the FISA Act, the only thing that the federal government had to prove from a probable cause perspective is that there is probable cause to believe that the target of the electronic surveillance under FISA is a foreign power or the agent of a foreign power, but doesn't have to prove any likelihood of criminal activity going on. Whereas with the Electronic Communication Privacy Act, there are three probable cause requirements that the federal government has to meet. First, it has to prove that there's probable cause to believe that the target of the wiretap is committing a crime, that the communication that the government wants to wiretap will contain information about the crime being committed, and then finally, that there's probable cause to believe that the communication device that they want to wiretap is being used in connection with the crime.
Okay, so we're much more solicitous of constitutional rights for Americans. Does this provide adequate protection? Does it properly balance these things? Again, that federal magistrate seemed to think maybe he had too much power as a practical matter under ECPA. Do you agree, or do you think that this is an adequate protection?
Well, what's interesting is, under this act, the requirements for the government to get a wiretap order or a warrant are actually higher than what you would find with a standard Fourth Amendment warrant to do a search, for example, of someone's home. So one could argue that that this higher burden is in line with both Fourth Amendment and the First Amendment concerns, because what the government is doing is not just searching for evidence of criminal activity, but is also wiretapping and listening in on our conversations, which has First Amendment implications.
Okay. So at least on paper, it looks like it has established an appropriately high constitutional bar. I understand that there is a current proposal to build on these statutes, or at least to go beyond where the FISA and the ECPA statutes go, to criminalize and define and combat domestic terrorism. What is this current proposal? Where is it coming from?
So sort of putting the Fourth Amendment question aside and moving a little bit closer to the First Amendment question, there is a proposal on the table that's been introduced in Congress. And what it would do is it would mirror or add to the crime of international terrorism and the federal laws that deal with international terrorism. And it would essentially add the crime of domestic terrorism to all of the crimes that govern international terrorism. And one of those crimes that has significant First Amendment, First Amendment sort of implications and maybe concern is a domestic terrorism crime that would outlaw material support for domestic terrorism. There is already a law on the book that outlaws material support for international terrorism. And so the idea is that we would also outlaw material support for domestic terrorism.
I know where you're heading with this one now. The Holder case comes to mind. Tell us about the Holder case and what it did with regard to international terrorism.
So in 2010, some American citizens wanted to coordinate with some groups that had been labeled international terrorist organizations by the Secretary of State. And so to step back for a second, the Secretary of State has the authority to designate an entity a foreign terrorist organization. It has to be a foreign organization. It has to be engaged in terrorism. And this terrorism has to threaten the United States. And so the Secretary of State had designated some terrorist organizations that Americans wanted to coordinate with, wanted to help. And these Americans said, well, what we want to do is we want to provide them some advice and some training that helps them resolve disputes within the context of peace negotiations and petitioning the United Nations and sort of peaceful efforts at attaining their goals. The problem was that runs up against those desires, that desire to talk with terrorist organizations and train them, that runs up against a law that outlaws providing material support to terrorists, international terrorists. And this law prohibits all the things that you would expect it to prohibit. So, weapons and money and false documents, but it also prohibits material support in the form of services like training and expert advice.
The Gilroy gunman's motive still eluding investigators tonight. He cut through a security fence to kill three people and injure more than a dozen on the last day of the day.
This country has seen a rise in violence by white supremacists. That includes the murders of 11 people at a Pittsburgh synagogue last fall, a deadly encounter at a white nationalist rally in Charlottesville, Virginia in 2017, the murders of 9 people at a church in Charleston in 2015, and the deaths of 6 people at a Sikh temple in Wisconsin.
So what makes a violent act an act of terrorism? It's a question many people are asking today across the globe and on social media.
Right now we believe it's a solo actor, a lone wolf type actor.
One of the things that we try to study when we look at these groups is the way in which they communicate both internally and then to the public.
I will say that a majority of the domestic terrorism cases that we've investigated are motivated by some version of what you might call white supremacist violence.
It's called framing. And the way we frame these stories is that if it's a person of color, it must be terrorism. If it's a white person, it's probably not. It's probably a mental health issue.
You're listening to your weekly Constitutional. I'm Stuart Harris, and I'm speaking with Doug McKechnie of the U.S. Air Force Academy all about the differences between combating terrorism internationally and domestically. Turns out, it's pretty complicated stuff. Stick around. And now it's time to finish our discussion with Doug McKechnie. We've been talking about domestic terrorism and some relatively recent statutory efforts to combat it. We've been discussing the case of Holder versus Humanitarian Law Project, a 2010 Supreme Court decision about material support being provided to foreign terrorist organizations. So this was a situation where they weren't doing the sorts of activities that the act was squarely aimed at. As you say, they weren't providing them with weapons or weapons training or anything of that sort. They were actually insistent that we're doing exactly the opposite. We're trying to reform these guys and help them to find relief for their grievances through peaceful means. And the government's position was, no, anything you do to help them in any way is going to run foul of this act. And of course, the First Amendment pops right up because they say, look, all we're doing is talking and we're advancing our political views and our sympathies with this group and our desire to help this group to become peaceful. How did the court rule?
Well, that's right. The folks who wanted to provide this assistance to the terrorist organizations, they said this is sort of fundamental, pure political speech. And we go back into the history of the First Amendment. The main sort of speech that the First Amendment was intended to protect was political speech, so that we could engage in the democratic process. And the plaintiffs in this case said, that's exactly what we're trying to do. We're trying to sort of express our opinion and advocate. And in addition, they argued that you're prohibiting our association, and we have a right to freely associate with whomever we want. And the Supreme Court said, you know, the government has determined that when you give assistance to a terrorist organization, whether it be a weapon or whether it be training or advice, that support is fungible and it's not compartmentalized by the terrorist organization. And so any assistance that you give to a terrorist organization is going to help facilitate their fundamentally criminal activity and fundamentally criminal ends.
Right. So in this particular case, one could argue that any assistance that they give this organization to help them peacefully resolve their disputes could also be seen as giving them help with lobbying and their political outreach, money that they then wouldn't have to spend, and so they can spend more money on bombs and machine guns.
Or if you want to think of another more nefarious example, let's imagine that someone gives some advice to a terrorist organization about how to negotiate, because we want to encourage peaceful negotiations by terrorist organizations to resolve their disputes. Mm-hmm. Well, if you teach them how to negotiate, what they might end up doing is they might take those skills and kidnap people and then negotiate for their release. And these skills theoretically are not compartmentalized to peaceful and non-peaceful outcomes. They can be used in various contexts, and some of those might be criminal activity.
Right. I mean, if you teach them how to use computers, then they can use the computers for terroristic activities. If you teach them more fundamentally how to read, I mean, anything you can think of that has an innocent objective can also then be twisted into a very non-innocent objective. Okay. So I understand the government's position, and I understand these people's position. So whose side did the court come down on?
Well, the court came down on the government's on the government side. Mm-hmm. And the court agreed with the government, even though the court said, look, this is certainly what we call content-based regulation. This mm-hmm. is the government telling these people they cannot say something that they want to say. The court said with regard to the concern with terrorism and, you know, combating terrorism being an objective that's what the court said of the highest order, this is wholly appropriate, and it is a very narrow category. The court thought it was a very narrow category of speech that that the government was banning.
This is in 2010, right?
That's correct.
In the last 9 years, I think it has crept into other areas, and isn't there at least one prominent lawyer, I think it was a woman, an older woman who had been doing this for years, was representing some people accused of terrorism and was doing what defense lawyers do. She was visiting her client in jail, and she was talking to him, to some extent serving as an intermediary with his family and friends outside. And I think she was accused of transmitting messages or orders that were then, you know, aiding and abetting the terrorist network this fellow allegedly came from. And I think she ended up going to jail herself.
That would be the concern, because, you know, when the statute talks about prohibiting or criminalizing advice or assistance, I mean, it's really focused in on expert advice and expert assistance.
Right.
And so, you know, if you're just imparting generalized knowledge to a terrorist organization, theoretically, that wouldn't fall within what's banned. But if you are providing advice, and with your example, certainly lawyers provide specialized advice, that could theoretically fall within the speech that's prohibited and could be criminalized.
Right, and then that would be a Sixth Amendment issue if you're denying effective assistance of counsel in a criminal prosecution by outlawing the legal services themselves. I mean, if you take this to its logical extreme, any assistance you give this person at all would theoretically be something that's criminalized and prohibited by this. So I think that was the major concern, if I recall, from when the Holder decision came out. And okay. So that brings us back to the current proposal. The current proposal, then, it sounds like, is going to build upon Holder and make aiding and abetting a statutory offense in a broader context.
So what's interesting is the Congress people who are proposing a similar law for domestic terrorism, so providing or outlawing the provision of material support to domestic terrorists, realize that there is a significant First Amendment component. And they realize that under the First Amendment, American citizens actually have the right to belong to organizations that advocate the overthrow of the government. American citizens have the right to advocate for the overthrow of the government themselves. Those are all protected by the First Amendment. And so what the proposal tries to do is to avoid the concern that you might run into if it's an American talking to an American organization, and this sort of fungible argument. I think the court is less likely to uphold that sort of distinction or uphold that analysis if it's a domestic organization. In fact, the court in Holder versus Humanitarian Law Project specifically said, we're not suggesting that the international terrorism law, the providing material support to international terrorism, would be the same analysis in the context of a domestic organization. So they specifically said we're not addressing domestic organizations. And so knowing that, the Congress members who drafted this new law said that what they're going to try to outlaw is not any material support, but only material support that is intended to be used to commit a crime like killing someone, kidnapping, assault, property damage, things like that. And so the idea is that they're outlawing speech that is intended to help a domestic terrorist organization do something criminal or nefarious.
Okay, so let's take an example of a domestic terrorist organization. Let's say I sympathize with the Ku Klux Klan. Let's say I am a white nationalist. It would be okay for me to say nice things to the Klan, my local Klan chapter. It'd be okay for me to give them money, which is a form of speech. It would be okay for me to help them procure some more robes for their next cross-burning ceremony, which again is protected speech. I would only run afoul of this material aid statute if I went out and bought them bomb-making material or bullets for their guns, knowing that they were going to use them in some sort of terroristic attack.
That's right, but there could also be a speech component to it. Mm-hmm. Theoretically, if the same sort of analysis is taken from international terrorism and applied to domestic terrorism, if you gave expert advice to a domestic terrorist organization and that expert advice was in, you intended it or you knew that it would be used to help that domestic organization kill or kidnap or do property damage, that speech, that expert advice could also be criminalized. So if I teach a domestic terrorist group how to build a bomb or the most efficient way to kidnap someone, theoretically that speech could be or would be outlawed and would be punished. And so that would lead to a First Amendment claim.
Even if I gave them legal advice, let's say I'm operating as the lawyer for my local Klan chapter, and I know what they want to do. They want to go out and bomb someplace. And I start giving them advice on ways that they might avoid electronic surveillance or things that they might find protected under the law. Essentially knowing that I'm helping them to evade this, that would be material aid and support. And so at least that part of my representation could be criminalized. That's really not groundbreaking, though, because that's the common problem that so-called mob lawyers have. I mean, attorneys can do a lot for their clients and their communications are generally privileged. But if you're actually helping someone in the commission of a crime, then that is not privileged. And it's something that the lawyer can go to jail for as well. So I guess it sounds like it's fairly standard fare. It really doesn't change the existing law that much again.
Well, again, I think I wonder if part of the effort is not simply to have a law on the books, because there really is no law on the books that specifically outlaws domestic terrorism, unlike, for example, international terrorism. There are laws that one can violate in furtherance of domestic terrorism, like murder, but there is no specific domestic terrorism crime. And so I think probably what you see here is the federal government attempting or considering whether or not we should define international terrorism and domestic terrorism the same way. You have the same laws that prohibit domestic terrorism in the same way that we prohibit international terrorism, prohibits support for international terrorism the same way we do, or excuse me, domestic terrorism the same way we do international terrorism, to try to elevate domestic terrorism to the same level of concern and response.
Well, again, I understand the importance of symbology. I understand the importance of, you know, directing people's attention to something. But I'll just go out on a limb here and say that this is all new to me, that it sounds to me like there are a lot of constitutional things that are going to have to be worked through, a lot of political capital that's going to have to be expended to get something like this passed, a lot of court challenges that are going to be brought. It might just be better to rely upon existing law and devote more resources, perhaps, as seems to be happening, to combating these things under traditional conspiracy theories and under traditional criminal law theories. I guess if I were in Congress, somebody would have to convince me that there was something concrete, something that was going to come of this beyond just the symbolic act of saying, look, we did something about domestic terrorism.
And I think that those who are against these new proposed laws, I think that's one reaction, is that we have laws in the books, and those should be used to the fullest extent of the law. In addition, I think the other argument is a constitutional argument, which is fundamentally American citizens, whether suspected of being engaged in criminal activity or domestic terrorism or any other sort of illegal activity, fundamentally American citizens all have the right to free speech. They have the right to advocate for advocate for violent overthrow of the government and violence. Those are all protected under the First Amendment. They have the right to associate with others, even when those associations are nefarious associations and are not engaged in sort of supportive and beneficial things to society. We've got First Amendment rights, and so it's a concern when we start to equate Americans with foreigners when it comes to the Constitution with regard to the First Amendment. And I think that has been borne out in the Fourth Amendment context with how we approach surveilling and collecting intelligence on foreign threats to national security versus domestic threats to national security.
Well, Doug, cutting-edge stuff. Anything else before we finish up here?
No, I think that's it, Stuart. I think we pretty much covered it.
Come back sometime and tell us more.
Thanks again, Stuart. I appreciate it.
Dolly Madison garnered a reputation not only as a hostess and socialite, but also as a strategic political partner for her husband, a role that women of the time seldom fulfilled. This role did not come without controversy, as the male-dominated political realm was not always happy with Dolly's influence. Dolly's longtime friendship with Washington gossip columnist Margaret Bayard Smith provided her a tool to defend her own reputation and that of her husband's, and to take jabs at their political opponents. Dolly Madison often acted as a surrogate in her husband's absence. In one instance, when James Madison could not physically reach out to Senator Henry Clay, Dolly offered to dip snuff with him, thereby maintaining James's partnership with the Warhawk senator. This is Tyler Stanley with your Madison Minute.
So, Emily Voss.
Stuart Harris.
Looking cross. Are you angry with me today? Or are you just in a bad mood?
This is not a ridiculous look, Stuart. Oh, my goodness.
I caught you off guard.
You did.
Okay. Emily, do you have a good quiz question today?
I do. Well, I always have good quiz questions.
Of course you do. I understand we have Mike on the line. Mike, are you there?
Yeah, I'm here.
Where are you from, Mike?
I'm in Harrisonburg, Virginia. I work at James Madison University.
JMU. We love James Madison University here, and we do
We love you all. So.
Well, thanks very much. And we met several years ago when I did the Madison Vision thing there, the Madison Vision series talk.
Yeah. So I've seen your constitutional quizzes before.
Oh, yes. We did a bunch of them with John Alger. We called him the quiz prez.
Yes.
and you were so inspired by that experience that you wanted to be a contestant on the show yourself.
Absolutely.
That's just wonderful. Okay, Emily, give him a nice hard one because he's a smart guy. He works for the president at JMU.
All right, well, let's do a throwback question to the Articles of Confederation.
Oh, my.
One of the lesser appreciated documents of the American founding. All right, which of the following statements about the Articles of Confederation is correct? A, there was no Supreme Court. B, to add amendments to the Articles of Confederation, the 13 states had to unanimously agree. C, each state had one vote in Congress. D, all of the above.
Ooh.
You want to hear those again, Mike?
No, I'm torn. I'm going to say all of the above.
All of those things are true of the Articles of Confederation. I'm just curious, what were they again? What were the choices again?
Sure. A, there was no Supreme Court. B, to add amendments to the Articles of Confederation, the 13 states had to unanimously agree. C, each state had one vote in Congress. Hmm. And then, of course, D is all of the above.
All right. So you're pretty sure of your answer then, Mike?
I'm 50% sure. You wanna, I have to choose between two options.
You want to phone a friend? You could call John Alger and ask for his help if you want to.
I'll stick with D. That'll be my final answer.
D is your final answer. Emily?
Well, if you're 50% sure, you're 100% accurate.
Oh, isn't that good. Nice? Congratulations, Mike.
Well, I knew B was correct, but mm-hmm. But the other one sounded correct to me as well, so...
Yeah, in fact, each one of those things was a really fundamental weakness of the Articles of Confederation.
Yeah.
You know, there are three basic functions of government. You make laws, execute the laws, and then you interpret them. And that last function of government was pretty much left out of the Articles. There was no judiciary, or at least no, you know, Supreme Court to be the definitive interpreter. So that was a problem. And then that unanimous requirement for amendment, I mean, can you imagine how difficult?
Right.
You can't change anything. And then finally, I guess one thing that was not necessarily a weakness but was very much criticized is the fact that every state had equal suffrage in the Congress, because of course that means that a tiny state like Rhode Island would have the exact same power that a massive state like Virginia did. And so that's ultimately why we went to a Congress with at least half of it being proportional representation. But that's fascinating and a good question, Emily. Thank you.
No problem, Stuart.
Absolutely, and thank you for playing, Mike. Now, here's the deal. You go to our Facebook page, Your Weekly Constitutional on Facebook, send us a message, give us your T-shirt size, give us your mailing address, and we will send you not only a pocket constitution from Montpelier, but a YWC T-shirt in your correct size.
Oh, awesome. Thank you.
You can be the first on your block.
So I only had to answer one question. That's great.
You get a T-shirt if you get it right. So congratulations, awesome. And thank you. And thank you, Emily.
All right. Thank you, Stuart.
And what's your tagline, Emily?
All right. We the people means girls, too.
Very good. And that's our show. Thanks so very much to my good buddy, Doug McKechnie, our First Amendment guy. And hey, we did get some First Amendment stuff in there toward the end, didn't we? Our executive producer is Wayne Winkler. Our scheduler is Carol Hutchinson. Our distribution engineer is Chad Barrett. Our music is by Hannibal's Elephants. Check them out. They've got a new album on Spotify. I'm Stuart Harris. And before I go, let me remind you that we are all over the internet. Just Google three words, Your Weekly Constitutional. You'll come up with our podcast site. There's a search bar. We've got, my goodness, close to 400 episodes now. You can listen to all of them if you want to straight through, or you can search for your particular topic of interest. We have a Facebook page. We have a Twitter account. We got everything. So go online and enjoy yourself. And remember, you are a part of the American experiment.